concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kboo.org.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, The Yes Man Fix the World, will play Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. The Yes Man Fix the World is the true story of two guys in thrift store suits who impersonate corporate bigwigs and follow the twisted logic of corporate capitalism to its conclusion, exposing the absurdities and ironies of an economic system that ruthlessly rules the planet. Again, that's The Yes Man Fix the World, Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to the wide world of fascism. Yeah, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe talk radio show. Abe's not here. I am. It's Joe, and I've had an exciting week, and I won't share any of it with you. But I will tell you that we are moving into what I consider to be a crisis of confidence and a crisis of democracy, unlike any previously in modern times, and certainly in my lifetime. And I want to hear from you. In fact, I think the more of you that call and talk, the better it'll be, because I think you all know where I'm coming from. It's all pretty obvious. On the other hand, let's just summarize things. Donald Trump, who is a fascist idiot. Now, I want to be clear here. I want to be very clear here. Fascist. That is a belief in a state which is a combination of corporate power and government power, and a total repression of democracy, a fascist state, and idiocy, my God. You'd have to be less than aware to not understand how he, and I'm so glad this is true, doesn't know how to work the fascist pedals on his bicycle. So let's talk about what's going on. How bad can it get? I've been very pleased, and I hope you have been too, and this is something really important. There's been incredible resistance to the Trump world. But it has to keep on, and it has to organize, and it has to become a thing. Not just a street protest and so on. It's got to really, really, really snowball, and it's got to involve people who normally would not bother with protest movements. And I want to hear from you, and I want to hear from you on your ideas and your reaction. And if you disagree with me, I want to hear from you as well. As you probably know, yesterday Trump fired the temporary attorney general, who had the audacity to say she didn't think what he was doing to immigrants was legal. And as you probably also know, the plan he carried out was inadequately prepped, thank goodness, and essentially trapped people in airports all over the world. Furthermore, it seems very likely that Trump will today nominate another justice to the Supreme Court who will be maybe Steve Bannon. I don't know, some kind of total right-wing anti-freedom guy or gal. And, I don't want to exclude women from this. And it looks to me like this is a crisis of constitutional proportion in which we really, all of us, whether you are a conservative or a liberal or a leftist or even a rightist, if you care at all about Constitution and about the American system, if you have at all any hope or desire to see our society grow and flourish, you're going to have to get involved. You're not going to be able to sit on the sidelines. It's just not going to happen. With that in mind, having said that, I'd like to hear from you, your ideas, your responses to the Trump crisis. The Trump crisis will be ongoing and unending. Fortunately, and I think this is really important, fortunately, he's an idiot. So you have a clown fascist, better a clown fascist than a Hitler. 231-8187. Who we got? Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to say that the Trump regime is the 21st century version of, and also the fast track version of, the Nazi revolution. The office of the presidency has been transformed into a virtual dictatorship by signing statements and legislation such as the Military Commissions Act, etc., by prior administrations, such as that of George W. Bush and Obama. It is conceivable and somewhat likely that eventually, in order to retain power in the face of public opposition, false flag attacks will follow. I'll let other callers take their place.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. All right, we're laying out, all of us, a very dramatic and I think realistic scenario around Trump. There was a tendency when he first ran for president to think of him simply as a right-wing clown, but he quickly got Steve Bannon, all these other people, all these weird people involved, and it became very obvious that the Republican Party had fallen apart in terms of its fundamental conservatism. It also became obvious, I'm sorry to say, that the Democrats were unprepared for this popular uprising of the right. So here we are. This guy got elected president, even though, and we always have to remember this, about 3 million people less than a majority voted for him. But the way in which our system is structured with the Electoral College, he got in. Now he's here. Now he's doing what he does. And we're beginning to get some sense of the enormity of the intention of the Trump administration. So as Lenin, oh my gosh, not Lenin, once said, we have to ask a very important question. What is to be done? Let's hear from you. 231-8187. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Joe. Good
morning.
Hey, I got two quick points. I won't take up a bunch of your time.
Okay.
But number one, I don't think any Democrat with his salt believed the guy had a chance, and they didn't get out and vote enough. So that's my defense of the poor Democrats that didn't step up to the plate, including me. But I voted. Okay, number two, do the people at Fox News, is it going to, you know, are they even going to begin to realize that, the chair they're sitting in is getting so hot they can't even sit in it anymore? Are they going to feel any of that heat?
Nope.
So expand on those subjects, will you?
Okay, sure. Well, I think that I will. The question of the Democrats and what happened. I think, unfortunately, Hillary Clinton, who had actually basically a very good liberal program, was lacking in charisma. A chief factor in getting elected in our system nowadays. And there was a lack of awareness of the danger of Trump until it was way, way too late. So that's a lot of what happened in the electoral process. As to the question of Fox News, we have to remember that Fox is the instrument of Murdoch and other right-wing elements. They are not interested in democracy. They are not interested in free speech. They are not interested in fair governance. They are on a trip with an audience which is fairly large and which sustains them. And of course, the other thing that's really important to understand about all this is the people who advertise love the kind of conflicts that are happening right now because it keeps people glued to their TV screens and so on. And there's no morality to that. And that's what's going on another level entirely. Now, will there be a turn away from that by those rich, powerful elements? I don't know. Remember that the head of ExxonMobil is going to be our Secretary of State. I mean, this is a very weird, very scary scenario. And I can see that Trump intends to fire. He loves firing people. You know, this is his thing. It is going to fire everyone who resists him. I'm hoping, and I believe it's going to be the case, that people in the State Department, that people in the various departments of the government of the United States and all the state governments will be turning their backs on him and quitting. But, you know, when you're supporting a family and you've risen to a certain level of importance in the system, it may be too hard for you. You may find yourself rationalizing, you're sticking around and saying, well, I can modify it and so on. But what needs to happen, and I'm hoping will happen, is all these career diplomats, all these career people in the various government bureaus will walk out. Will say, no, we're not going to do this. This is fascist. This is wrong. We're not going to support this crazy clown. I'm not sure that'll happen, but I'm beginning to think that's going to be a response. Meanwhile, all of you, all of us, need to be in the streets, need to be in a position to raise holy hell. This is the crisis we all fantasized and feared. It's nothing less than that, and it could be a great deal more than that. Because when you have a fascist clown in charge, you've got a serious set of problems that very directly challenge any kind of democracy. All right, let's hear from the others of you, 231-8187. And, of course, if you disagree with me, give me a call. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that saying he's a fascist clown in some ways, especially the clown part, maybe not the fascist part, but the clown part minimizes the very real, the violence of all that he's already done and the destruction that he's already wrought on, you know, people from around the world, peaceful American citizens who did nothing wrong, absolutely nothing wrong, except they were born in a different, in a place that he doesn't approve of or had a religion that he doesn't approve of. So I think that he's a clown, sure, in some ways, but he's a grotesque more than anything else. You know, he's...
Well, I think that's an interesting... I think I agree with you in a way, and he is a grotesque. But the reason why I say clown is because he did this whole move against against people from these other countries, these Muslim majority countries, without any real thought or preparation, without letting various bureaus know. He did it as almost like a coup d'etat. So I say clown. But not, I won't argue with you. Grotesque is just as good.
And my last point is, you know, I think that there was a lot of division on the left before the election, and the right consolidated just enough around their candidate, and the left fell apart just enough that, you know, he was able to win, and he consolidated those Republican votes. And so I just think that going forward, we have to say, look, this is an evil force that we're battling. And I understand that all Democrats are not perfect, and that some Democrats, you know, are more in touch with corporate interests than others. But we have to get his party out of power, and it has to start in 2018 in the midterm election flipping 29 seats. You have to flip 29 seats in 2018, and you have to hang on to those Senate seats in the Senate, and then, you know, then you're at the midpoint and you have no longer have a Republican Congress and a Republican rubber stamp president. I mean, it's terrifying. So that's what we really have to focus on, and we have to think about civic activism that's geared towards flipping those seats in the election and taking back the House.
Okay, I don't disagree with you. I think that in terms of just generally legitimate politics, that is absolutely necessary. But I also think the Women's March, I think what happened yesterday in reaction to the exclusion of people from other countries, those are also extremely important activities, not just because they get a lot of attention, but because they rouse in everybody a real sense that they can resist this fascist trend.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay,
thank
man.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Hey, take care. 231-8187, we're talking about, I'm going to keep calling him a fascist clown, because, to be fair, I would have called Hitler a fascist clown. Of course, ha-ha, not so funny, but I've never found circus clowns very funny. 231-8187, let's hear from you. Camilo.
Hi. I would like to have some discussion about the resistance and what I see as a trend to abandon the principle of nonviolence in the resistance. And there have been a number of examples of this. There are discussions on Facebook about, is it okay to punch a fascist? And a lot of people are saying, yes, it's okay. We saw at the airport somebody was knocked out.
And, yeah, I don't know what actually happened there, so I can't comment on it.
It's visible on films that were taken at the airport.
Okay.
But another thing that the films demonstrate is that there were people in the resistance who were trying to restrain some of the more aggressive protesters.
Mm-hmm.
So this is introducing division, and if we succumb to the loss of the principle of nonviolence, we're only going to be opening up ourselves to provocation and eventual repression. And I think that we in the resistance have to stand very strongly in support of the principle of nonviolence. And I would like to hear from the people out there to echo this and to add their solidarity to this. Yesterday at the rally in Terry Schrunk Plaza, there were many people, a lot of children, and someone was arrested in a car going around and who waved a weapon.
Wow.
So that's an example of the increasing threat. And yes, can happen right here in good old Portland.
Well, I'm going to let you go, but I want to thank you for bringing this up because it's a topic that I've been thinking about a great deal. I was raised, I'm a kind of old guy, and I was raised in the tradition of nonviolence as a political activist. I was very much, I think I've said this before, but I was very much interested in and influenced by the Catholic worker movement. I am not a Catholic. I am not a religious person. But I was very influenced by Dorothy Day. I was very influenced by Martin Luther King and by others who struggled in a nonviolent way. Nonviolence is, I think, the most significant tactic, particularly when you're facing an overwhelming force of the state. And that was the case in the South. That was the case in many cities in the North. As we were being persuaded to have a nuclear war, as we were being persuaded that persons of color should not have rights. And I really, really appreciate the tactics of nonviolence. I mean, we went very far. We would even wear suits to demonstrations. We would allow ourselves to have our butts kicked. And we would do this with the view that we were demonstrating a model that should be followed, particularly when you're dealing with superior force. And there's no question that when you're dealing, for example, with the police who are organized and trained to be violent, you are dealing with superior force. So I actually agree with the caller. I really do believe that nonviolence is a key power in this situation, particularly when, in fact, none of us, I don't think, are comfortable with, what do I call it, civil war? So, you know, nonviolent techniques, the training of people toward nonviolence, is and will be very, very important during these struggles. It doesn't mean that you have to be nicey-nicey. It doesn't mean you can't yell, scream, shout. But it does mean that you don't confront unnecessarily the enormous power of either the state or the elements of the fascist regime. So, having said that, I'd like to hear from you, all of you, on this topic as well. 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hey, let's look at the big picture. I think this really needed to happen. This was the logical conclusion of the representative part of representative democracy, which got corrupted. The whole representative thing was designed to allow us to have our voices heard hundreds of years ago when you had to take a horse and buggy to the state capitol or to Washington to make yourself heard. And now that was so subject to corruption, that representative part, because and now the representatives don't represent the people, and they're unnecessary. The whole representative part is unnecessary because of the internet, and it's time to replace it. We could do it local. We could do it on a local model.
First. I'm not sure what you mean by replacing representative democracy. Can you
with deep or direct democracy?
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which, like direct democracy, everybody gets a say in everything, which you could do with computer. And individuals groups could be weighted in states where they have a low population or underserved people could be weighted by, you know, the computer could do that. We could do random polling. You could actually do really random, and juries, the jury system. You could have juries of experts, you know, chosen at random. We can do, you know, that whole system, that whole representation thing, it just got corrupted out of hand. And even before Trump, it was like, it was going down the tubes.
Mm.
I think this needed to happen. We need a revolution. We need to get a whole new way of democracy. Deep democracy, that Switzerland does some of it, or direct democracy, and they do a lot of referendums, and they're like dabbling in it. And Arnie Mandel talks about deep democracy, including emotional states and things like that. But I think we can do it, and I think we need to do it. I think we can do it in Portland. I think we could get everybody to sign up on a, you know, with a computer on an email. And, boy, if we get, you know, if the new mayor could get, like, you know, 90% of the population, he could get quick referendums, and, you know, we could start a whole new model.
I won't say that it isn't an interesting idea. My general position on electoral politics is that the Oregon vote-by-mail system is the most incorruptible and therefore the one I favor the most, given that we do ordinary elections. I do appreciate your idea. I haven't really explored it. I'm a little worried about some kind of impulse-driven politics. I think thoughtfulness is very, very important, and the fundamentals of the Constitution, both state and national, are very, very important. But I thank you for the ideas, man.
Sure. You know, the Constitution was written when you had to have representation.
Well, the Constitution... Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Somebody had to physically represent you.
Well,
that's when the Constitution was written. And it's so archaic now. That was hundreds of years ago.
But remember that large numbers of people, particularly poorer people, don't necessarily have access to electronic media.
We could give it to them.
We could provide them.
Yep, we could provide it.
Okay. Thank you for the call, man.
Sure. All right.
I have to read stuff here. It says, at 9, Alternative Radio presents one of the most important and rarely heard speeches from Martin Luther King Jr., recorded at the Riverside Church in New York 1 year before his assassination. That's the talk he gave about Vietnam when he challenged a lot of his followers to recognize the evil of the war in Vietnam. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts presents Furious Flowers, the most celebrated black poets of America, pay homage to the life and work of poet laureate and Pulitzer Prize winner Rita Dove, a great poet. At 11:30, it's Art Focus, interviews with curators, critics, and artists. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? Hey, get with it. You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Please remember, we don't have commercial sponsors. We are dependent on all of you. This is your radio station. This is your democratic instrument. And your support of it, Democrat small d, your support of it is absolutely crucial to its survival. Okay, back to the question. I'm saying, what is to be done? To quote Lenin. Lenin. And how is it to be done? I'm arguing for nonviolence. I'm arguing for large activities, demonstrations, as we are actually seeing, both spontaneous and planned. And I'm arguing for a process that will absolutely challenge the false authority of Donald Trump and Bannon and these, I'm going to call them fascist clowns for the time being. Anyway, let's hear from you. 231-8187. Bear, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Joe.
Morning.
You know, in the past, you've talked a lot about friendly fascism, and it seems to me that that's kind of like Washington. You've got the Trump clowns, and then you've got the old-line Washington warriors who are sort of more like the friendly fascists. And my fear is that if we ever do get Trump impeached or whatever out of office, that the people will feel so relieved and so happy that they'll go along with the friendly fascists who really want to get us into another war.
Okay, well, that's an interesting fear, and I don't know that you're wrong. I'm less concerned right now with that than with absolutely stopping this incredibly weird phenomenon of the support for popular support, and there is a lot of it, for Donald Trump and for his fascism.
Well, I think we ought to think a little step beyond that. Sure, let's get Trump out of there. I think we might realize that a lot of people voted for Trump because the regular system failed them, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that one of the things that's really clear is that the Democratic Party, really beginning with Clinton, the president, failed to deal with the needs and concerns of working class people, and their needs for education, their needs for better incomes, and in general, saw that they were not being, their needs were not being met by the Democratic Party.
Anyway, I guess that's my main point. Let's kind of think one step ahead and keep our eye on the friendly fascists, so we're just kind of waiting to pick up the pieces.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 231-8187. We're talking about the incredible weirdness of Donald Trump. We're talking about the fact that resistance within agencies of the federal government is beginning to be apparent. I am kind of excited by that, but I'm also horrified by President Bannon, by the overall right-wing-ishness of the government of Donald Trump. I like to call him a fascist clown, but there's less and less that's funny. Of course, I've never found the guys in the big shoes and the makeup very funny either. 231-8187. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, I think we're already beginning to see what looks like the most, to me, the most substantive resistance. The mayors of the sanctuary cities, a number of them have already stepped up to say, we will see you in court. And I think this is the essence of what has to be done. It's sue, baby, sue. And when you see unconstitutional edicts coming down, when you see unconstitutional enforcement, the lawsuits need to be mounted. I called you a couple weeks ago and said there are lawyers standing by to take your call. And if we can put, if your movement can put hundreds of thousands of people in the street, and we have the power of the internet, you could mount massive teams of investigators to start looking for anything to and everything to sue this regime over. And that's what you could tie these guys up in court. When you see unconstitutional, anything unconstitutional, start making databases of this stuff, spreadsheets, collect the information. The lawyers will take it from there. And we're already seeing this happening, and that's on the forefront. The other thing that the sanctuary cities could do is point out that the threat of withholding grant money to the cities is to some degree a paper tiger. The money goes both ways. If the city of Portland, for example, were to count up the amount of money it sends to Washington in the form of withholding tax for its employees, Social Security, Medicare withholding, all of that money it sends to Washington withheld from its employees, and said, we're going to cut you off. If you cut us off, we're going to cut you off, and we'll see you in court over this issue. And that's where it that's where it has to go. Take it to the courts, and you'll get some results. Also, whistleblowers need to be supported and propped up. Say, if you see unconstitutional behavior within your agency, blow the whistle, blow it loud, blow it early, blow it often. And it has to be done in this way if you're going to really get... make some progress. That's my opinion about it. And you know, there's one last thing. If he really wants to do the investigation of the election in terms of voter fraud, I recommend that any of the people in Congress who would be sitting on any committee that is overseeing this investigation, that they become very aware of the investigative work that Greg Palast has done on voter suppression and vote fraud, not voter fraud, but vote fraud in the context of voter suppression. He's done a tremendous amount of research, and the mainstream people that are interested in, that might be interested in this stuff, need to be made aware of that. You never hear the name Greg Palast on national propaganda radio. You only hear him in the alternative media, like KBOOF, Flashpoints, you know, your own people there. I've interviewed him a number of times. He's got to become a household name Okay, so those are some points, and I will just leave it there. And
well, I appreciate it. I'm glad you mentioned Greg Palast. I think he does great work. All right. I guess I'm using this kind of old Lenin quote just as a starting point. What is to be done and how is it to be done? You know, what's really interesting to me is that people like myself are a little bit late to the game in the sense that spontaneously and authentically, people are outraged and are in the streets. The Women's March, the various responses to the exclusion of people from various countries, the choice of Christians over Muslims as people who gain entry to the United States, all of this has roused a large number of people. Now, the core Trump supporters don't see, or at least don't yet see, the implications of this potential of absolute fascism. The fact that guys like Bannon are going to be essentially the government, replacing, you can't call Trump a theoretician of politics. He's an entertainer. He's a front man. He gained his fame by being mean on TV. So, you know, what's really happening here is a scary transition into a system of authoritarian rule to the right. And I want to know what we all can do about it. I am enthusiastic about the large numbers of people who've turned out so far. I am enthusiastic about the idea of resistance. I do believe that we all need to adopt a more, what's the right word? Well, a more nonviolent position, because we are not going to be the people with the guns. We are not going to be the people with the bombs. We are going to be the people who are pacifists and who are genuinely interested in democracy. And that's where we need to have our strength based. And I'd love to hear from you. 231-8187. Francis, you're on the air. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Your song at the top of the show was very nostalgic from the 70s.
60s, actually, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. I feel it's kind of deja vu for me, but what I agree with your last caller and also the one who was discussing nonviolence. But what we have to realize is that behind this made-for-TV president is Pence and McConnell and Ryan and Cruz, people like that who are just gloating over the fact that we have someone who is willing to do their beck and call. I'm concerned about that. Because if Donald Trump is impeached because of his silly actions, then we still have those people to deal with.
Well, that's a very good point, actually. A very important point.
Also, as your last caller said, I was heartened by all of the ACLU attorneys who showed up. And I understand that they have received donations three times what they usually get annually. They've already received over the weekend. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. And I think that where our democracy is being tested, we're going to see if the third branch can save liberty.
By which you mean the courts.
The judicial, yes, the courts. That's where we're at right now, it seems, because our Congress is dominated by, I call them bigots, and people who go along with the bigots. And hopefully at some point we'll realize that we need to keep this going. And I think there is a fourth branch, and that is we the people. And we have demonstrated very clearly that we are here in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's been quite amazing, actually.
Right, yes. And perhaps at some point we'll realize, as we are saving our democracy, that we need to also save the people who have already been caught up in the web of bigotry and hatred, who have been massively incarcerated, mm-hmm. and who are right now suffering what we are afraid of.
I think that point is carried on. No, I think that that latter point is very important. It's really clear that the exceptions made in the, I believe it's the 14th Amendment, have made it possible for persons of color, for example, to be incarcerated in unreasonable numbers.
Right, and the 14th Amendment was meant to protect those people's rights. And I feel that it's being violated.
Actually, it's the 13th Amendment. I misstated.
The 14th Amendment, which provides equal protection under the law, was intended to protect the people who had been recently freed. And it's a violation of that 14th Amendment to me every time a corporation uses it.
You mean the creation of the fiction of a personhood for a corporation?
Right, and every time a corporation calls on that 14th Amendment for equal protection, is violating it, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
And one other thing, the women, the five judges who have stopped proceedings of this executive order are... judges that have been appointed for life. And also, I would like to mention a woman. Her name is Tulsi Gabbard. She's a senator from Hawaii. She just recently visited Syria, and she has proposed a bill, and I think she has a Republican to co-sponsor with her, that is to stop all of this regime change wars that we're doing all over the world. Because while we're here fussing about what this television president is doing, we are bombing in Yemen, in Libya, in Iraq, in Somalia, in all those countries that Trump has on his list. Bombing is taking place there right now, and there is more collateral damage and more children being traumatized. And Tulsi Gabbard, to me, has a very clear picture of what needs to happen in this world, and we need to check her out.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Glad you called. All right, 231-8187, want to hear from you all. And by the way, I wish we had more women callers. I'd love to see it like, you know, 50-50 or something. I know that there's a pattern, having done commercial talk radio, where men tend to dominate. I don't think it's necessarily a good thing. So if you're a little timorous, don't be. Give us a call, 231-8187. David, you're on the air.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I think I have, it's, you know, there's a lot to say, but I think I have kind of two points I want to make. I think that the outrage and the public outcry is completely appropriate. Obviously, the things that this administration is doing are terrible. You coming up? I got a toddler in the background.
That's all right. We like toddlers.
You do. Good, good, good. Well, it's good. We kind of have one in office, so that works. so the things I think I want to say are one, that while the outrage we're seeing now is great and appropriate, I think it's been lacking for the last administration, because a lot of the things that are going on now were going on to some extent during Obama's administration. Basically renewing the nuclear arms race, terror watch lists, coming down harder than any other administration on whistleblowers, like one of the previous callers was talking about. And also, Obama set a record for deportations. So, again, while the outrage now is completely awesome and appropriate, I think it's important that we not look to the Democratic Party necessarily for answers and for resolution in the future. Because those are now things that the Democratic Party does, and it's okay, apparently. My second point, you talk about nonviolent demonstration, which is excellent and important. I think I would want to make a distinction between, you know, and I don't know a lot about protesting and nonviolent action, but I would want to make a distinction between destruction of property and anti-capitalist demonstration and violent demonstration. So I think that if people are, I think in November we saw folks breaking windows and smashing car windshields over on the east side.
Well, you know, I think that was only, as far as I know, it was one or maybe a couple, three people that were doing that. Mostly everybody else was just hollering.
That's true. But is it necessarily bad that people were doing that? And I think it's important for us to recognize that the violence is coming down. Basically, what we're saying as a society in responding with tear gas and pepper spray is that we value property more than we do people. Mm-hmm. So if we're okay with this kind of response from the police, and we're going to say, okay, you guys, you stop breaking windows, destruction of property is bad, and are we hurting local businesses? Yeah, I mean, that's happening, and that's not – I think it's important to be strategic, but we need to not value – property and capitalism over the health and safety of our people.
Okay.
So, I think those are my points.
I think those are good points, and I appreciate them. I do want to make one comment on this whole issue of fighting the police. I didn't plan to spend time on this particularly today, but strategically, fighting an armed force, which is trained to shoot, even to kill, and going into a battle on the streets might be brave and cool at some level, but it also is almost pointless. There is no way that when you use your physical resistance and your own, what do I want to call it, your own fighting force, that you can win. The state always has the advantage until a certain point is reached historically. And to me, the strategy has to be nonviolent, because you gain sympathy, you gain empowerment, you gain courage, and you take away the legitimacy of those who would use violence. Anyway, that's just my feelings. 231-8187. Sean, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe.
Morning.
So I just, it's not what I call, but I just want to kind of disagree with what you just pointed out and agree with what the fellow just said, and that is that I think a great example, you know, I mean, there's the struggle between violent and nonviolent protests, but I think a great example of gaining attention and a lot of change happening from violence breaking out against the police and where they don't win was the civil rights movement. There was a great amount
of that.
Yeah,
but it was all done nonviolently.
No, it wasn't, because when you saw a lot of the reaction of the basic public who were attacked by the police in the South, who were trying to defend themselves, that brought a lot of attention and forced LBJ to do something different. Anyway, but that's not the reason I called. I called because, ironically, I've just read about the first 30 pages. I've been meaning to read this book, but I would recommend anybody to read it if they haven't, and that's Jane Meyer's book, Dark Money. It came out last year. And it's my main thing is that I think a lot of in this discussion around Trump and the distractions and so forth is nobody really gives strong press and brings attention to the dark money. And specifically, I'm talking about the Koch brothers and so on and all the so-called philanthropical organizations they create, which allows them to write off money to fund all these things that undermine democracy and put people like Donald Trump in power.
Okay. I certainly agree that her book is very important. And I certainly think there is a lot of evidence of dark money in our politics. What's kind of interesting right now is that the older conservative movements, including the Koch brothers, are a little bit nervous with the crazy clown, you know?
Well, they may be, but I think that what we underestimate is even though they try to officially present themselves as though they don't support him, they actually do. It's just like the disturbing thing here just within the last couple of days of discussing the Holocaust, but so appropriately leaving the Jews out of it.
Mm.
That is totally in support of the white nationalists. You know, and so I don't want to take up a lot of time. I know there's a few minutes and other people, but I just want to quote a couple of things. Their father was disturbed years ago. He helped to build refineries and help Stalin and Hitler in getting oil to fund their regimes.
You're talking about the Koch brothers now.
Yeah, now their father, and a lot of people don't realize it. And I'm just going, you know, and so what they learned from that is, in one of their employees, is that they believe justice, and this is, goes back to, I think, a couple of calls ago, Francis saying, you know, it needs to rely on justice. Well, you know, Howard Zinn said, if you want justice, you can't go to the Justice Department. And they believe that justice, and this is quote, quote unquote, they believe justice can be bought and rules are for chumps. Basically, rules are for fools. And that's exactly what the kind of thing we're seeing. You know, and she started that whole thing off that there was a gigantic meeting literally while Obama was being inaugurated in 2009 that all the wealthiest families were meeting in Indian Wells, California, to discuss how they were going to go about undermining this very process of democracy. And one of the great families specifically that she mentions is the DeVos family, who, of course, was nominated for Department of Education. You know, I mean, I just really think that we get distracted. He is the face of this very monster that has really taken over what's called democracy. And here's what I want to finish. And this is the quote, and I've heard it before, but she starts the book off. We must make our choice. We have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. From Louis Brandeis, who is the Supreme Court Justice.
I appreciate your comment, and I actually agree with the quote.
Me too. Thank
you. Thank you very much. Right now, today, and I don't know, it may have already happened because I haven't looked at the news recently, the Trump administration will be putting forth their candidate for justice of the Supreme Court. And a real test of the whole system will be how well the Democrats in Congress resist that candidate and how well the American people resist that candidate for the Supreme Court. Because if one more vote is there, we're going to have a much harder time. And it's a very, very tricky situation. And I think we all need to be very clear and make clear to our Congress people what our expectations are for a member of the Supreme Court. Anyway, let's hear from some of you, 231-8187. Michael, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So I've been reading up a lot about all of this since Trump got elected, and I have a couple of things that I think are worth saying.
Okay.
First of all, the blue votes are inefficiently distributed geographically. You could gin up enthusiasm among people who you call blue voters, and, you know, they're all kind of packed into cities. And if that was all you did, the next time there's a presidential election, you'd get like 10 million more in the popular vote instead of 3 or 4 or whatever it was. And you'd still lose the Electoral College because all the blue voters are packed into the cities. So you can't just like preach to the converted and manage to win a presidential election that way. That's the first point. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that means you've got to convert some Trump voters, which could be possible because there were plenty of people, significant numbers of people that voted for Obama both times and then they voted for Trump. So that's what whatever movement this turns into would need to do, actually, if it really wants to do something other than, you know, make itself feel good. So that's the second point. And then the third point is there's this very interesting article from the Washington Post. The title of it is, In Venezuela, We Couldn't Stop Chavez. Don't make the same mistakes we did. And the subtitle is, How to Let a Populist Beat You Over and Over Again. And he makes a few points, and the one I think that's relevant right now, given what's going on, is show no contempt. Okay?
Show no contempt?
Show no contempt.
I don't think I'm emotionally equipped not to have contempt for Trump.
Well, then you may not be emotionally equipped to do anything successful. Listen to what the guy says. And this is a guy from Venezuela who fought Chavez the whole time and noticed what they did that was effective and what they did that was ineffective. Okay, show no contempt. Don't feed polarization. Disarm it. This means leaving the theater of injured decency behind. This includes rebukes such as the one the Hamilton cast gave to Vice President Mike Pence while sincere, it only antagonized Trump. It surely did not convince a single Trump supporter to change his or her mind. Shaming has never been an effective method of persuasion.
I don't know if that's true, but go ahead.
Okay. Then the last paragraph of that section goes, the worst you can do is bundle moderates and extremists together and think that America is divided between racists and liberals. That's the textbook definition of polarization. We in Venezuela thought our country was split between treacherous oligarchs and Chavez's uneducated, gullible base. The only one who benefited was Chavez. So, I mean, if you want to talk across the divide and convince some people who went for Trump that maybe they shouldn't go for Trump or somebody like Trump, the first thing you have to stop doing is telling them they're a bunch of morons.
Well, I don't disagree with that point. That is, just dissing people who supported Trump is not adequate response. I don't have time for a discussion of the failings of the Venezuelan left right now. It's probably a show for another time, and it's something that really does need to be discussed, but it's much more complex and has a lot more to do with international politics and the support of Cuba than it has to do simply with the popular movement that was dominant for a while in Venezuela. But I appreciate your points, and I think they're interesting.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. 231-8187. I think we have time for a couple more calls. Amy, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You know, I actually think that, you know, my opinion builds on the last caller in that I did not realize just how ignorant I was in assuming Trump supporters, you know, are ignorant themselves. And that's not to say it's not there, but of course it's going to be on both sides, it always is, to some respect. And what's amazing to me is that so many of the Trump supporters that I'm finding are either misinformed or perhaps both sides of us are not realizing that many of us, especially, you know, the blue-collar workers, which is the family I grew up in, you know, we definitely did not come for money or anything, and my father raised me, if you're going to be a toilet washer, you'd be the best you could possibly be, and you take pride in what you do, and you work hard. Well, on the opposite side of that, I have also really benefited from the aid that, and the way that our state here in Oregon uses, not just the federal money, but really about how they've helped me go to school. They helped me raise my son when I was single, you know. And there were a lot of areas that they helped me find a job. There were just so many areas where I do hear that in these other states that aren't predominantly blue, I guess, you know, there are a lot of people that are struggling, and perhaps the states are fighting against a lot of this aid. You know, I've never had an abortion or anything, but Planned Parenthood, oh my goodness, it just helped me get my regular cancer screenings, you know, because of an illness that I had and things like that when I just could not afford it. And this all happened under the Obama administration. You know, I lost my insurance before I needed a very important surgery. And, I mean, I wasn't at that deep. I paid for my insurance. I got it. And they found something and decided they could call it a pre-existing condition. And I was destroyed by it for a long time. I had to claim bankruptcy due to my medical debt. And after Obama came in, I was finally able to get insurance again and take care of myself again for my son, which is going to help me work. You know, it's going to help me. So it's amazing to me how there are, you know, issues on both sides, but of course the media is also different in different states. And so that's where I feel communicating, whether it's social media, whatever it is, communicating with the Trump supporters as well and trying to find our common ground, because there really is so much of it, rather than focusing on the divide and the extremes.
Well, I'm going to cut you off, not because you're wrong or anything, but we're running out of time. And I just wanted to get this in here because it's very important. I think that a large number of working class Americans, by the way, I hate the term middle class, which was used by the Democrats so much in this last election. It's working people, working class people. And they felt, and without a really good economic analysis, that they were being hurt and cut off. The fact of the matter is that our work situations are changing, and that the society more and more doesn't need the labor of less educated individuals. So it's really an important crisis of another kind entirely. But I do want to thank you for your call, and I think you're making some very good points. I really appreciate it. Well, gee, I think we've run out of time looking at the clock. I want to thank you all for your patience. I appreciate the calls. I hope that Abe will be back with me next week. And I do hope that you, all of you, will hear this and feel strong and will continue to struggle and will be in the streets and will be sending messages to your congresspeople and to your local legislators and to your local governors and mayors and so forth. We can win this. It will be hard. But this is the struggle of the age, and we must turn all of the people, regardless of their left-right leanings, into aware people about the dangers of a Donald Trump administration.
From the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all, it's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay.
Hey, it's Shenna from Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. Join us this Friday at 9 a.m. for a special live episode where the entire Pacific Underground crew will join me for a lively roundtable discussion about new political policies affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders. We'll also have live interviews, and we'll be taking your calls to talk about what's important to you and your API community. So tune in for a special Pacific Underground this Friday, February 3rd at 9 a.m., right here on KBOO, your community radio station.